Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan podcast by night, all day.
So, first of all, thanks for coming, and very nice tie.
Thanks. Christmas present. Actually, Ryan Cole is the one that first got these, and my wife has been jealous ever since, so this is what I got for
Christmas. Where does one get a COVID tie?
I don't know. She looked it up on Amazon or someplace and found it.
You got to love how industrious some of these folks are. They just, you know, they find a niche. Like, I know what I'm going to sell. COVID ties. And there you go.
I gotta have a tux for an event that's coming up in Texas in a couple of months. And so my wife is writing to the guy that does the ties and to see if he can make a bow tie that's got the virus on it.
Are you tired of this?
Tired.
Dealing with this? Do you feel a duty to talk about this? Like, we should just say, because historically, we should just state what's happening here. So today is the 30th. Of December, and yesterday you were kicked off Twitter, correct?
True.
We scheduled this in advance. It's just coincidentally that you were kicked off Twitter. What were you kicked off? Well, first of all, before we even do this, please tell everybody what your history is and what your degrees are and what you do.
Okay, so I'm going to do the short version.
Okay.
This can last for an hour if we go into the whole history of mRNA vaccines and all that kind of stuff. My history. I was originally a carpenter and a farmhand in the Central Coast of California, and decided that I wanted to go back to school, and did 2 years of computer science, and then decided that I didn't want to spend the rest of my life looking at a computer monitor in a basement. Bad decision. And decided that I wanted to try to become an MD, which was a hard thing to try to do in the late 70s. So that was a real stretch objective. Went to UC Davis after 2 years of undergrad at Santa Barbara City College, and wanted to work on this new tech space called molecular biology, and in particular on cancer. My mother was deathly afraid of breast cancer. And so I looked around and found a laboratory at UC Davis with a guy named Bob Cardiff and another guy named Murray Gardner that were working with retroviruses and their links to breast cancer. And it just happened that while I was in there, this is circa 83, 84, this whole thing cut loose in San Francisco with the immunodeficiency syndrome in men. And the lab ended up right at the forefront of that. You know, Davis is just down the street, basically, from San Francisco. And at the Davis Primate Center, they had discovered that there were monkeys that had immunodeficiency. And so I was there in the lab as an undergraduate, as a total bench rat, when Preston Marks and Murray Gardner and others made the first discovery of a retrovirus basis for immunodeficiency in primates. And then Murray went to the Pasteur, brought back the virus literally in his pocket, went there with Bob Gallo, met with a guy named Luc Montagnier that you may know, and that kind of kicked off the whole vaccine effort for AIDS. So that's kind of what I cut my teeth on. And so I came out of that. It was really bold to think that I could get into medical school. And I kind of overshot the mark. I got an MD PhD scholarship at Northwestern University in Chicago. And so I went from having grown up in Santa Barbara with my wife, we were high school sweethearts, to Chicago. And that was kind of an abrupt transition. So we decided I would do my graduate work at San Diego. And I'd been accepted into a program at UC San Diego that had two of the top gene therapy specialists. I really wanted to do gene therapy with retroviruses. That was what I thought was going to be my life. And so we moved down to San Diego, and I started working in the laboratory of Inder Verma, which is in the molecular biology and virology labs at the Salk Institute. And this is a place where graduate students normally aren't allowed to go. There was seven Nobel laureates at the time, plus Jonas. A really intense competitive environment. Carved out a little niche that I was going to work on for my graduate work, which was asking questions about how retrovirus RNA is packaged. And from that, I had to develop a series of technologies to manufacture RNA and structure it and eventually put it into cells. And that, through a cascade of events, being at the right place at the right time, asking the right questions, surrounded by geniuses, led to this series of discoveries that now forms the basis of the RNA technology platform that gives rise to these vaccines. And 10 issued patents from they were all filed in 89. So that's kind of my origin story, that it relates to this virus and vaccine and this. But since then, went on, finished my MD, did two fellowships at UC Davis, taught pathology for years, set up a gene therapy lab, had many other discoveries, came out to the East Coast, created the technology platform that is now the basis of the company called Inovio. We actually originally founded Inovio in the United States. This is pulsed electrical fields. They have one of the DNA vaccines for COVID. Then the planes hit the towers. The investors pulled back. And I went to work for a company called Dynport Vaccine Company that had the prime systems contract, as government speak, for all of the biodefense products for the Department of Defense for advanced development, which is to say clinical trials through licensure. And that's my kind of transition from being an academic to focusing on actually making things that work in people. And the big epiphany there was that the world is full of these academic thought leaders that publish in big journals and stuff, but that doesn't really lead to products. And I really wanted to make products that would help people. And so since then, for the last, I guess it's about 20 years, I've been focused on actually doing stuff, regulatory affairs, clinical development, getting the necessary training, et cetera. Completed a fellowship at Harvard University Medical School in as a global clinical scholar to round out my CV. And I've run, you know, over 100 clinical trials, mostly in the vaccine space, but also in drug repurposing. I've been involved in every major outbreak since AIDS. This is kind of what I do. I've won literally billions of dollars in federal grants and contracts. I'm often brought in by NIH to serve as a study section chair for awarding, you know, $80 to $120 million contracts in vaccines and biodefense. I've spent countless hours at the CDC, at the ACIP meetings. I have multiple friends at the CDC. I work closely with Defense Threat Reduction Agency, which is and it's one of my favorite clients, partners, teaming partners. And I work with the Chem Biodefense Group. There's other branches, including the other, this is not the branch that funded the Wuhan labs. That's another branch of DITRA. I've got many friends in the intelligence community. So I'm kind of a pretty deep insider in terms of the government. I know Tony Fauci personally. I've dealt with him my whole career. And then we had this particular outbreak. And I was tip of the spear on bringing the Ebola vaccine forward that we now call the Merck Ebola vaccine. I'm the one that got Merck involved.
Now, when the pandemic broke out, previous to that, I mean, you're kind of thought of as a heretic now in some strange way.
And, pariah.
Yeah, pariah is probably a better word. And the fact that you've been banned from Twitter is it's very confusing, because I've been following your tweets and I've been reading all the things that you've written, and I don't understand how it justifies a ban. And I don't know what was the particular tweet. Did they tell you what the particular tweet was or what the offense was?
That they never tell you.
They never told you.
Well, they never tell anybody.
They removed you for not going along with whatever the tech narrative is, because tech clearly has a censorship agenda when it comes to COVID, in terms of treatment, in terms of whether or not you're promoting what they would call vaccine hesitancy. They can ban you for that. They can ban you for, in their eyes, what they think is a justifiable offense. And they're doing this, and I don't know who these people are that are doing this, but they're doing these this one of the most important things about you reading out your history like that is to one of the most qualified people in the world to talk about vaccines.
Well, thank you for that. I think that that's – so one way that some people put it is – and, of course, since this has happened, I've been contacted by multiple lawyers that are looking at filing a suit, just like Alex Berenson has one against Twitter. And the point is made just what you just made. So the point that I think is kind of succinct on this is if my voice, if there's no merit to my voice being in the conversation, whether it's true or not, whether I'm factually correct or not, let's park that just for a minute. Whether or not I'm right in everything I say, and I freely admit no one's perfect. I'm not perfect. That's one of my core points, is people should think for themselves. And I try really hard to give people the information and help them to think, not to tell them what to think. Okay? But the point is, if it's not okay for me to be part of the conversation, even though I'm pointing out scientific facts that may be inconvenient, then who can be allowed? Whether you're in the camp that says I'm a liar and I didn't invent this technology despite the patents, when there's a whole cohort of that, no one can dispute that I played a major role in the creation of this tech. And virtually all other voices that have that background have conflicts of interest, financial conflicts of interest. I think I'm the only one that doesn't. I'm not getting any money out of this. So I think that it starts to touch on some fundamental constitutional principles about rights of free speech. I suspect that's kind of where you're going on that.
Well, most certainly, but also how disturbing it is for someone who's not an academic like myself to watch people like you get silenced. And silenced in this platform of social media where people are exchanging information, they're posting up studies, and you're discussing different parts of this pandemic that are in the news and what the issues may lie in and where your background and your expertise allows you to explain this in a way that maybe it's not being explained because of the narrative that's being discussed in the mainstream news. And to watch you get silenced, first of all, to watch you get ostracized. I've seen that. I've seen people distance themselves from you. I've seen people call you a crazy person and criticize you, but with no specific thing to point to. It became like a tag they put on you. Like, oh, that guy. Like, I brought you up to someone, and he goes, oh, that guy's crazy. I go, how so? There was no answer.
Yeah.
So, like, okay, so this is a thing you're going to just say someone's crazy when they say something that's inconvenient or say something that makes you uncomfortable because you've decided to accept a certain narrative. Did Twitter warn you?
No.
Was there any tweets where they said that this is misleading or anything?
No.
No.
They never do.
Do you have any idea what the final tweet was or what the context was?
I think I do, and there's no way to confirm it until the lawyers, you know, do their lawyering.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did have, in the case of when I was banned from LinkedIn, remember this happened.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, I was deplatformed from LinkedIn many months ago. And there was actually two events of deplatforming in LinkedIn. And in both cases, I was able to get an explanation for what the specific crimes were, the thought crimes. And in the first one, it was a tweet, a LinkedIn posting, in which I pointed out that the chairman of the board of Thomson Reuters also sits on the board of Pfizer. And I simply wrote, does this look like a conflict of interest to you? Okay. And this gets to your core question about tech. It's not tech. It's the horizontal integration across all major industries now under the control of common funds. All of these industries, the harmonization of the tech censorship, the interests of pharma, big media, et cetera, and governments, all being harmonized in their messaging globally. I mean, I travel a lot. Okay, I see the same, and I have physicians coming to me all the time about what they're experiencing. The same playbook is going on every continent. Okay, but getting back to LinkedIn, so this is the first event, And Steve Kirsch intervened, called up a vice president of LinkedIn.
And Steve Kirsch is a tech guy, right?
Yeah, he is. He's a Silicon Valley entrepreneur who you may or may not recall that I was on the Brett Weinstein Dark Horse podcast with Steve that kind of lit this whole fire up months and months ago.
That's right. Okay, that's where I first saw him.
Yeah,
okay.
So he has great network connections in Silicon Valley. He invented the optical mouse. And so he called this vice president of LinkedIn. The guy looked into it. Meanwhile, people started dropping off of LinkedIn in protest. And there was major press articles all over the world. And then they reinstated me, and I actually got a very kind letter. This is unprecedented, personal letter from this vice president apologizing and saying specifically that they didn't have the talent to fact check me. And then, therefore, they were going to let me go. Now, then, subsequently, I got dropped again, and a phone call was made, and they got put on. In that case, the sin was that one of their fact checkers, because remember, this is Microsoft, one of their fact checkers had identified the Atlantic Monthly article, attack article that was written about me, and concluded that I was an anti-vaxxer, and therefore I should not be allowed on LinkedIn. Now, the context for that that's fascinating is that Atlantic Monthly attack article that is often cited by my detractors, and it's a fascinating read. We could go down that rabbit hole, but no reason. It was written a few days after Peter Navarro and I came out with an op-ed in the Washington Times in which we criticized the Biden policy on vaccines and said that they should be reserved for those that need them most and not used universally. And we said some other things about the need of testing and tools so that people can assess their true risk. It was a political retaliation intended to take me off the map as I was starting to interact more of in a public policy sphere. Now, with this Twitter event, my wife and I have racked our brains about what is likely to have been the tweet that triggered this. And, you know, you never know. The last two that I can think of that went out was one that was on our Substack in which we referred to a fantastic video that has been put out by the Canadian COVID Care Alliance Group that summarizes all the malfeasance and data manipulation and misinterpretation associated with the Pfizer vaccines and their clinical trials. It's a super video. And, of course, that is interpreted as something that would cause people to become vaccine hesitant. That's the sin in general, is saying things that cause people to become vaccine hesitant. The other thing that I put out immediately before that was a link to a website for the World Economic Forum that lays out their entire strategy for how they manage media, how they're managing COVID-19, and all of their core messaging. It's a fascinating website with links. Those are the only two things I can think of that would meet the criteria. So, you know, my position all the way through this comes off of the platform of bioethics and the importance of informed consent. So my position is that people should have the freedom of choice, particularly for their children, and that in order appropriately choose to participate in a medical experiment, they have to be fully informed of the risks as well as the benefits. And so I've tried really hard to make sure that people have access to the information about those risks and potential benefits, the true unfiltered academic papers and raw data, et cetera. And the policy that's being implemented is one in which no discussion of the risks are allowed, because by definition, they will elicit vaccine hesitance. So it can't be discussed. But that's the fundamental background. That's the backbone of informed consent. So informed consent is not only not happening, it's being actively blocked. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, and it's unprecedented. I mean, I can't recall a time ever where people weren't able to discuss the side effects of medication, whether or not the studies are accurate, whether or not people should universally take these things or whether it should be done on a person-by-person basis. This is it's a very strange time. And so when someone who's an expert like yourself has a dissenting opinion and you see that dissenting opinion immediately silenced or at least immediately criticized and then these attempts at silencing, it just signifies how confusing and how troubled the times we're in are. When COVID first hit, when the lockdown started happening in March of 2020, what was your position on all this?
So you're kind of asking my origin story with COVID.
Yes. I mean, were you initially have you taken the COVID vaccine?
So the answer is yes. I've also been infected twice.
After you took it?
Once before. I was infected at the end of February because I was attending a MIT conference on drug discovery and artificial intelligence.
So this is pre-lockdown?
Correct.
February of 20?
But it goes back further than that. There's a CIA agent that I've co-published with in the past named Michael Callahan. He was in Wuhan in the fourth quarter of 2019. He called me from Wuhan on January 4th. I was currently managing a team that was focusing on drug discovery for organophosphate poisoning, ergo nerve agents, for DITRA, Defense Threat Reduction Agency, involving high-performing computing and biorobot screening, high-end stuff. And he told me, Robert, you got to get your team spun up because we got a problem with this new virus. I worked with him through prior outbreaks. So it was then that I turned my attention to this, started modeling a key protein, a protease inhibitor of this virus when the sequence was released on January 11th as the Wuhan seafood market virus. And I've been pretty much going nonstop ever since to that point with drug repurposing. I'm the one that originally discovered famotidine as an agent. Because I was self-treating myself after I got infected with agents that we'd identified through the computer modeling.
So February of 2020, you get infected. And how bad is your case?
Bad. I thought I was going to die. You got to remember, I was up on all the latest information from China and everywhere else. I knew all about this virus. I knew, you know, I've been watching the videos of people dropping in the street. My lungs were burning until I took famotidine, and that relieved that.
And what is famotidine?
It's otherwise known as Pepcid. So just to on this tangent, since I've said it, I've got some good news to announce. First time here. Today, we believe we should have the first patient enrolled in our clinical trials of the combination of famotidine and celecoxib for treating SARS-CoV-2. This is trials being run by the company Leidos, which is one of my clients, that I've helped design. It's based on my discoveries. They're funded by Defense Threat Reduction Agency. So this is another drug combination. Now, I work with all these folks like Peter and Pierre that I know you know.
Peter McCullough, yeah. Pierre Corey.
But I haven't pushed this drug combination. I just felt it was inappropriate until we got the trials running. But they're now open. And we've passed through the FDA screening process. By the way, we had data showing that adding ivermectin further improved the combination. But the FDA created such enormous roadblocks to us doing an ivermectin arm that we had to drop it. And by we, what I'm saying is the FDA created so much grief that the DOD decided the juice wasn't worth the squeeze, and they just dropped that arm.
Why do you think that is? What do you think is going on with the pushback on ivermectin?
So it's not just ivermectin, it's hydroxychloroquine. And just to put a marker on that, there's good modeling studies that probably 500,000 excess deaths have happened in the United States through the intentional blockade of early treatment by the U.S. government.
Half a million.
That is a well-documented number. Okay, and it's the combination of hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. Now, when you ask me why, you're asking me to get into somebody's head. What I can say as a scientist is what I observe. The behaviors, the actions, the correspondence, these bizarre things like, you know, don't you know it's a horse drug, y'all, right? Which is amazingly pejorative. I live in Virginia, okay? I can tell you the people around me, I live in a rural county and I raise horses. That was deeply offensive to use that language in that way. But there's clearly been an intentional push. And Zev Zelenko, who's a buddy, the guy that came out with the original protocol, the Zelenko protocol, and was the one, by the way, that wrote the letter to Trump advocating for hydroxychloroquine. Okay, kind of important to put that together. He's put together a great little video clip in which he clearly documents the conspiracy between Janet Woodcock and Rick Bright to make it so that physicians could not administer hydroxychloroquine outside of the hospital.
And who is Janet Woodcock and who's Rick Bright?
Rick Bright was the head of BARDA, the Biomedical Advanced Research Directorate, which is the group that, for instance, funded the J&J vaccine and Operation Warp Speed, et cetera. So they're the big ticket funder in Health and Human Service of biodefense products.
And who is she?
Janet Woodcock was head of Operation Warp Speed for drugs and until very recently head of the FDA. She is known as the person who kind of gets the credit, let's say, for the opioid crisis for her role at the FDA.
So between the two of them, there was some sort of a concerted effort to suppress the use of hydroxychloroquine?
Rick Bright, in videotaped testimony, has explicitly spoken about how they conspired to cook a strategy using emergency use authorization to make it so that hydroxychloroquine could only be administered in the hospital, which, by the way, is too late for when hydroxy should be used.
And why did they do that?
That is what is the unknown, and there's so many whys and hows behind this. I like to say there's a stack of stuff that doesn't make sense that's about this high. Now, there is – I can't prove. I can't get into Rick's head. I know Rick quite well. I don't know what – he's currently working for the Rockefeller. He did a whistleblower case, and then he left the government. But all I know is they did this, and Rick admits on videotape that he did it. And he states that the reason is that he believed there was no evidence of hydroxychloroquine being useful for this virus. Now, that's false. Hydroxychloroquine was known to be effective against SARS-1.
Wasn't that regular chloroquine?
Hydroxy and chloroquine are closely related molecules. Hydroxy is slightly less toxic. By the way, one of the nice things, we had actually filed during Zika, I did a lot of drug repurposing, and I filed patents on the use of hydroxy in Zika. One of the reasons is because hydroxy is one of the few molecules that have antiviral activity that are safe in pregnancy. And you remember Zika was a pregnancy issue.
Yeah.
So hydroxy's been out there for a long time as having antiviral effects. And the other part of Rick's story that kind of doesn't make sense, that there was no data on efficacy, is that I was the guy that first acquired, because I had Chinese connections, the Chinese protocol for treating this virus. I got it in late February. And I sent it in to my buddies at the CIA and at the ASPR, at the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response. So the government had those documents when Rick Bright made those determinations. So the assertion that there was no data on hydroxychloroquine at the time when this decision was made is just patently false. It's there. So what is the motivation? You're right. None of this makes sense. And the only thing, you know, this is a journalist problem. And, you know, the classic guidance is follow the money.
Yeah.
And so it is bizarre that Merck would come out with these explicit statements about the safety of ivermectin. Both ivermectin and hydroxy are on the WHO list of essential medicines. They have been administered for millions and millions of doses. They're among the safest medicines we know when administered within this acceptable window, pharmaceutical window. The ivermectin is even safer than hydroxy. So Merck coming out of the blue and saying ivermectin isn't safe is really inexplicable. Now, another thing is that I sit on the active committee for drugs as an observer. What is the active committee? This is the NIH committee that's guiding the clinical trials for these various repurposed and novel drugs. I saw, listened to, heard, witnessed the representative of Merck that's on the committee, because the committee is full of pharmaceutical representatives, even though it's an NIH public committee, explicitly attack the decision for the federal government to test ivermectin. She said there's no reason to do this. Now, what's happened since then is Active Sticks is still testing ivermectin, and they've had to go to a higher dose because, as we pointed out, essentially their initial trial design was designed to fail. It was a short course with inadequate levels of drug. And so now they've upped it to, I think it's 5 days and 600 micrograms per kg. That's the current dosing in Active Six. But there is clearly a concerted effort on the part of multiple players in the pharmaceutical industry in concordance with the federal government to kill ivermectin as a potential alternative early treatment strategy.
And if you're going to follow the money, the problem is there's not a lot in ivermectin because it is a generic drug and any compound pharmacy can make it and it's fairly cheap.
It's fairly cheap because it's easy to make. Yeah. In, you know, you can get ivermectin in bulk at less than a penny a dose.
Wow. So the original SARS is it 90% similar to SARS-CoV-2?
Those terms 90 or 96 or 98, those are really not, they're kind of irrelevant. You can have something that's 99.9% similar, and the difference is all the difference.
But if chloroquine worked on the original SARS, or it showed efficacy in original SARS, is it safe to assume, like without adequate tests, that hydroxychloroquine would work on?
It's the decision that was made by the Chinese government. Okay, that's my point. I got the original Chinese protocols. This is what they were using.
And they were using it effectively?
Yeah.
Yeah. So were they using ivermectin as well?
No.
No. But other countries have, like Japan and India and...
Uttar Pradesh, as you know, has crushed COVID.
Yeah, could you explain what they did to do that? Because it's kind of fascinating.
It's not clear what are the drugs. So what they did do, what we do know, and there's some backstory to this that we could go into if you want to. But the observation is there was a decision made. The virus was just ripping through Uttar Pradesh. It has almost the same population as the United States. It's huge, okay? Dense, urban, poor, all the characteristics of the stereotypes of the Indian countryside. The virus is just ripping through there and causing all kinds of death and disease. And the decision was made out of desperation in that province to deploy early treatments as packages widely throughout the province. And it included a number of agents. The composition has not been formally disclosed. It was done in coordination with WHO. And whatever was in those packages was rumored to include ivermectin. But there was a specific visit of Biden to Modi, and a decision was made in the Indian government not to disclose the contents of those packages that were being deployed in Uttar Pradesh, which they're still there. And Uttar Pradesh is flatlined right now. The rest of the world is yelling about Omicron and hospitalizations. Well, South Africa isn't. But Uttar Pradesh is still flatlined in terms of deaths.
So they were visited by someone in the Biden administration?
There's a meeting between Joe Biden and Modi.
And believe that out of that meeting, they decided?
I don't know what they said. I wasn't invited. All I know is that immediately afterwards, there was a decision not to disclose the contents of what was being deployed in Uttar Pradesh.
It's so crazy to imagine that in the middle of a pandemic, there's one place, one area of India that's extremely successful in combating the virus, and they're not going to say how they did it. I mean, that's That's nuts.
That's where I kind of – my stance in all of this is to say, here are the facts. Here are the verifiable data. Draw your own conclusion.
Okay. Now, February of 2020, you catch it. What did you take?
Famotidine.
Famotidine and anything else?
No, there's nothing else available.
So this was so early on in the pandemic. How did they – did you wind up being hospitalized?
Nope.
No?
I did develop long COVID. And people always – I always get the, why did you take the vaccine? Well, I took it fairly early on. I took Moderna because that's what the National Guard was deploying in my very rural county in basically central northern Virginia.
Isn't there some evidence that the vaccine actually helps people with long COVID?
That was the rumor at the time. I took it for two reasons. I had long COVID. It was supposed to help with that. And I knew I was going to have to travel internationally to France and Portugal in the near future.
Now, is there any evidence that the vaccine helps against long COVID? Or is there anecdotally, is there anything?
Anecdotally, there was. And I have not seen a peer-reviewed solid publication or preprint that supports that now. But that was the active rumor at the time. And since then, what we do know for sure, well documented, if you've got prior COVID and natural immunity, you have a higher risk of adverse events from the jab. Now, the other part of my story that often gets overlooked, so I took two doses of Moderna. With the second dose, I developed stage 3 hypertension with systolic blood pressure of up to 230. Okay, I'm lucky to be alive. You know, what it means